Hello everybody, lecture 7 today. Today we will finish the driven harmonic oscillator and we will immediately apply what we've done there to quantum fields. And then we will have a little bit of a preview of what changes when you have harmonic oscillators that are not driven, but that are, not driven by an external force, but are driven by change of the parameters, change of frequency. So the driven harmonic oscillator continued. Remember the time dependence of the Hamiltonian. We're working in the Heisenberg picture. The state is frozen. The operators evolve in time. This is true at all time because we work in the Heisenberg picture. And we've chosen our variable A suitably so that the Hamiltonian takes this simple form at all times. We found that at early times, the Hamiltonian reduces to this. It's constant in time. This is the initial A operator. And while the driving force is acting, remember, it only acts from time 0 to time capital T, there is some complicated expression that determines, that describes what the Hamiltonian is doing. We can write it down, but it's messy. And we won't need it. And at late times, the Hamiltonian is free again. The harmonic oscillator is free again because the source, quantum field theoretically, we will speak of the source term. In quantum mechanics, this is the driving force term. So that term is absent at late times as well. And therefore, the Hamiltonian reduces to this simple expression with the A out operators. And we found a simple relationship between the A out and the A in operators, namely A out is given by A in plus J naught being a Fourier type integral over the driving force. Okay, so at early times, before the force starts, we diagonalize the Hamiltonian. We found this, as we just said above, and I'm putting here H subscript T smaller than 0, early time Hamiltonian. It's constant, which is also expressing that the energy is constant. The operator for the energy is constant. All measurements of energy constant. The predictions for them is constant. We used the commutation relations between the A in and the A out, as the A in and the A in dagger, these ones, to construct a basis in the Hilbert space. A basis that is tailored to these operators. This is a basis, the so-called Fock basis, which diagonalizes the Hamiltonian at early times. The Hamiltonian at early times, H subscript T smaller 0, applied to one of those Fock basis states, gives us an energy eigenvalue and that state again. So the Fock basis vectors are eigenvectors to the Hamiltonian at early times. In fact, they are all of the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian at early times. The eigenvalues, En, in, are given by h bar omega, n plus 1 half, the usual spectrum of a harmonic oscillator of frequency omega, where n is running from 0 to infinity in integers. The ground state has energy 1 half h bar omega. The eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, the Fock basis vectors, were constructed in this way. We started with a vector 0 in, annihilated by the A in operator, and then by applying successively more powers of A dagger in, we obtained vectors, different vectors in Hilbert space, each of which is an eigenvector of the Hamiltonian, it turned out. So for example, if we take here 5 in, it's a dagger in to the fifth power applied to that vector, which is normalized. But the fifth power of a dagger in acted on that vector. That gives us a vector which is no longer normalized. It takes this prefactor to make sure that this whole thing is a normalized vector. And I think I left it to you as an exercise to prove that that's the case. So 5 in is then a normalized vector. And if you apply the Hamiltonian on that vector, you will find that it is an eigenvector and its eigenvalue is 5.5. Right? It's 5 plus a half. Okay, so we have a basis in the Hilbert space. This is a particularly useful basis when we talk about the early stages of the evolution before the force acted. But remember that we can use this basis anytime we want. It's just that it's convenient at early times, but usable at any time because it's just a basis. It knows nothing about the dynamics. It's just convenient at early times. Now, at late times, our Hamiltonian has evolved and it has become a different operator. The Hamiltonian at late times is h bar omega and then a dagger out, a out plus 1/2. It has the same structure as the Hamiltonian at early times, but it's not the same operator. Because, remember, this is the Heisenberg picture. The operators evolve in time. Therefore, the energy operator knows all about the prehistory. It is constant in time, however, clearly, because at late times, you know, this is ht larger than capital T, the force has stopped acting. So whatever whatever the harmonic oscillator does, its energy can no longer change. And indeed, the Hamiltonian comes out to be a constant operator on Hilbert space at late times. What are the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian at late times? Well, we can construct a Fock basis again. Now we use the A out and A dagger out operators to construct the Fock basis. And again, since the structure is the same, the commutation relations are the same, even though the operators are not the same, the relations that they obey are very similar, we find that the Fock basis constructed out of the A out and A out dagger is again an eigenbasis of this Hamiltonian. It diagonalizes that Hamiltonian. So what are the eigenvalues? What are the eigenvectors? Well, we have that A out has as its commutation relation with A out dagger also equal to 1. How do we see that? Well, A out is basically A in up to a constant. And so is A out dagger. And constants, which is to say multiples of the identity operator, drop out of any commutator. So the commutator of A out and A out dagger is clearly bound to be the same as that between A in and A in dagger. So we can construct the eigenbasis of the late time Hamiltonian with the same method as we did earlier for the early time Hamiltonian. And we find that again, there is a unique vector 0 out in the Hilbert space, which is annihilated by A out. The same way that 0 in is annihilated by A in. Where this vector 0 here, this O, is the 0 length vector in the Hilbert space. It's a neutral element with respect to addition in the Hilbert space. That 0 is a very different thing. It indicates ground state of the harmonic oscillator and has nothing to do with 0 lengths or something. These guys are going to be normalized, length 1 in the Hilbert space. This thing has length 0, the 0 length vector in the Hilbert space. Yep?
How do we know that there is, in the same Hilbert space, there is a vector that is annihilated by An and another vector which is annihilated by A out? How do we know that they exist?
Well, you have to... I was hoping that you did that in quantum mechanics. It ought to be a topic of quantum mechanics. in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, where you do the quantum harmonic oscillator, you can calculate those things explicitly and see. I mean, basically, you make the conjecture that it exists, you figure out its properties, and then see if you can construct it. And you find that you can construct it. And what you do for that purpose, you calculate what its wave function is. For example, you calculate what the wave function is of zero out in the position basis. And what is that? The wave function of zero out in the position basis is the ket bra of a position eigenvector on the left and the zero out on the right. That's the wave function, position wave function for that zero out vector whose existence we are conjecturing. Then the defining equation for that becomes a differential equation for that wave function. And then you check whether that differential equation has a solution. And that way you can do this. So here we are cutting this a little short because I'm just assuming that you've seen the harmonic oscillator and you know that its ground state energy is 1/2 h bar omega and so on. So we're just matching. I'm not proving it. I'm just matching it. I'm just saying that if we go by this construction, we are constructing vectors whose properties are identical to those which, by other means, we established are the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian. But to do it cleanly, yes, we would have to translate that into a concrete problem whose solution we can work out by, let's say, differential equation methods. OK, so we assume, or we conjecture the existence of such a vector, and we see whether we can construct an eigenbasis out of it. So it's a vector that's annihilated by A out. And then we construct, as we did before for the N in, we construct a whole set of other vectors out of this one. Namely, we apply A dagger out an integer number of times on zero out. Zero out is, by construction, this is just the way we do it, of length 1. We make sure it's of length 1. But this doesn't guarantee that this whole thing is of length 1, as we discussed earlier. Once you apply the fifth power or the nth power of A dagger out on this, you get for sure another vector, and its length is not 1. You have to divide by this factor in order to get a vector that's of length 1. It was an exercise last time to verify that this is the proper normalization. Then the proposition is that the late time Hamiltonian applied to n out finds that n out is an eigenvector of it, where the eigenvalues are the eigenvalues of the usual harmonic oscillator. No wonder, because it's free again. It's a free harmonic oscillator. Its eigenvalues are the eigenvalues of a free harmonic oscillator with frequency omega. So the En in are given by h bar omega times n plus 1/2. Again, without proving it, we just put the proposition out there that these vectors form a complete basis of our Hilbert space. This goes back to the spectral theorem of functional analysis. The Hamiltonian is a self-adjoint operator, therefore its eigenbasis spans the Hilbert space. Let me just make that comment. We have now two bases of the same Hilbert space. And on some occasions, one basis may be the best to use, and on other occasions, the other basis may be better. We could always choose to use instead the position eigenbasis, momentum eigenbasis, or angular momentum eigenbasis, or whatever we want. The choice of bases is just a matter of convenience. It's not intrinsically anything to do with the physics of it. So what do we have? At late times, the system, when it's in this state and out, is in the nth excited state of the harmonic oscillator. At early times, the system is in the nth excited state if it's in the state n in, which is a different Hilbert space vector. That's very important. For example, let's say that the system starts out at early times in the state 0 in. So the harmonic oscillator started out at early times before the force acted in its ground state. Let's call that state gamma the state of the system. Since we are working with the Heisenberg picture, the system is always going to be in the state gamma or 0 in. It's not evolving. Only the operators are involving time. Meaning that even after the force has acted, while the force is acting and after the force has acted, this is the state of the system. We expect, of course, that the system at late times is no longer in its ground state, because it has experienced all this driving. Which is to say that we expect that the vector zero in the Hilbert space, which we identified as being the ground state of the harmonic oscillator at early time, is not actually the ground state of the harmonic oscillator at late time. It's not this vector. So this was eigenvector to the Hamiltonian, to the lowest possible eigenvalue early. But at late times, this is not an eigenvector to the Hamiltonian, which is perfectly reasonable because the Hamiltonian has evolved in time. It's no longer the same operator. So this vector need not be an eigenvector of the Hamiltonian at late times. This is an eigenvector of the Hamiltonian at late times, the lowest energy eigenvector, but those two vectors in general won't be the same. Which is to say that the harmonic oscillator will have become excited, right? Because if the harmonic oscillator stays always in that state, as it does, and that state is no longer the ground state, well, then it means that the state is an excited state at late times. But if the state of the system started out as the ground state of the Hamiltonian, and then the force acted, what state is that then? What role does this state play? How excited is it at late times? This state, the same Hilbert space vector, acquires new meaning. And what is that meaning that it acquires at late times? Here we remember that the n in vectors form a basis of the Hilbert space, the n out vectors form a basis of the Hilbert space, which means in particular that every basis vector of this basis is some kind of linear combination of the basis vectors of that basis, and vice versa. So there must be coefficients such that we can write zero in particular, zero in, as a linear combination of n out vectors. And we do know what the interpretation is of the n out vectors at late time. They are simply the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian. So there must exist coefficients lambda n, just a name I'm picking out of the head, there must be coefficients such that the zero in vector can be written as the sum over those coefficients times the n out basis. This must be true not on the grounds of physics, but just on the grounds of math. If these guys really form a basis, and they do, then any vector, including this one, must be a linear combination of those. Any calculation of how operators and vectors between in and out relate to each other is called a Bogoliubov transformation. And much of the physics of quantum field theory in curved space is to do with Bogoliubov transformations one way or the other. So this is going to be a very important relationship, the relationship between in and out, between before black hole forms and after black hole forms, before cosmic inflation happens and after cosmic inflation has happened. These transformations are called Bogoliubov transforms, and they are really just ultimately change of basis. It's a particular change of basis that tells us everything about what happened in between early and late. The sum total of what happened, not the details of what happened, but the sum total of what happened. That's because the lambda n have a direct meaning. Let's say the system starts out in the ground state. So because it's the Heisenberg picture, the state of the system is frozen to be this state. And now imagine that at late times, after the force has acted, we measure the energy. We measure the Hamiltonian. So we take this observable and we measure it. Then what is the probability amplitude for finding the energy eigenvalue En? Remember, we are measuring the Hamiltonian. It has a discrete spectrum. If we measure the energy, we are bound to find one of those eigenvalues of it. Right? That's just the nature of measuring a self-adjoint observable. So if we measure the energy, we're going to find one of the eigenvalues. And the eigenvalues En, we know, h bar omega times n plus 1/2. So how likely is it to find any one of those energy eigenvalues? Well, clearly, if the system is in the state gamma, then the probability amplitude for finding the state n out at a late time is given by this bracket, the bracket of n out and the state that the system is actually in. And that's the probability amplitude. If we take the modulus square of it, we get the actual probability. So let's calculate that. Very easy. So gamma is the state that the system is in, the state that we prepared it in. N out is one of the energy eigenstates at late times. That's the bracket of the two. And we are writing 0 in, which is the state gamma, as this linear combination of M out vectors. I changed the name now to M because we have N already used here. So 0 in is a linear combination of all the basis vectors of the diagonalization of the late time Hamiltonian with the coefficients lambda m that we still have to calculate. And what do we get? You see, these are basis vectors of the same orthonormal basis. Therefore, n has to equal m in order to give us a non-zero contribution. And we are summing over all m. There's going to be a contribution only when m happens to be n. We get lambda n over here. Remember that the n outs are normalized. Okay, so the probability amplitude for finding the harmonic oscillator in its nth excited state, or later on in quantum field theory, for finding n particles of a particular momentum to be created, the probability amplitude for finding the harmonic oscillator later in its nth excited state is given by lambda n. So clearly, if we can find out what those coefficients lambda n are, then we know what the net effect of the driving was. We can calculate with what probability the harmonic oscillator has what energy after the driving ended. Namely, the probability for finding the harmonic oscillator in the nth excited state at late times is just the modulus squared of lambda n, because lambda n itself is the probability amplitude. This kind of calculation will give us then, in quantum field theory, the probability for finding n particles of a particular momentum after an interaction. So let's calculate what lambda n is. Proposition is that it's that. Was that obvious? Probably not. Let's prove it. Okay. So the claim is, in other words, that the ground state at early times is this linear combination of the basis at late times. Okay, that's the basis at late times. There was bound to be a set of coefficients such that when we sum over all basis vectors at late times, we would be able to represent that vector in that basis, right? So this is from the early basis. This is from the late choice of basis. Clearly, there's got to be coefficients. And the claim is these are the coefficients. These are the lambda n, right? Lambda n were the coefficients that we put in here. So that's the claim. How do we prove that? Well, we know the defining property of this thing. We know that it is annihilated by A in. There's only one state in the Hilbert space which is annihilated by A in, and that's the one. The harmonic oscillator has a unique ground state, and that's how you can pick it out. So all we need to check is whether A in, when applied to 0 n, is equal to 0. I mean, this we know. But this is a claim that this is 0 in. Okay, so we have to check whether this whole thing is annihilated if we apply A in to it. But if you apply A in to this thing, what do you do with it? Then you have A in act on N out. It's not obvious what the action is of A in on N out. But that's easy to fix because we can express A in terms of A out using that defining equation. Remember, A out was defined in this way. So this equation we can rewrite. Instead of checking that A in applied to 0 in is equal to 0, we are checking whether A out minus J naught, which is A in, applied to 0 in is equal to 0, and for 0 in we plug in all of this conjecture here. And now we have an operator A out acting on A out material here, on the N out vectors. So let's check that. We want to check whether this equation holds. So we have A out minus J naught here, and then the conjecture for 0 in is that 0 in is really this. All right, how do we work that out? Well, let's rearrange things a little bit. This factor here doesn't depend on n. We can pull it in front. Okay, so this factor goes here. It goes in the front of everything. And we put that factor over here. And now we have the sum over 1 over square root of n factorial j naught to the power n, 1 over square root of n factorial j naught to the power n. Everything is here. And then how about this one? This we can spell out. We can write what this is. Remember the Fock construction. This is that. Okay? It's obtained by applying A out n times on the vector 0 out, and then multiplying with this prefactor to make sure that it's normalized. Okay, so this much is just a rearrangement of what's written here. And then this vector is spelled out explicitly the way that it's constructed. Actually, I have modified this a little bit. If you have printed out notes, it will be a little different. I'm trying to make things a little clearer because this is a crucial step. So I inserted a bit more explanation in this page. Okay, so how do we go from here to here? You see that this prefactor is just carried forward. And then we have A out acting on all of this. But all of this is really, really something simple. Because we have really 1 over n factorial. Okay, it's twice the square root, the product of 2 square roots. It's 1 over n factorial. And here we have something to the nth power and something else to the nth power. And I hope you recognize that this is the exponential function, therefore. Right? Sum over n, 1 over n factorial, j naught times a dagger out to the power n, which is this. Okay? So we have a out times all of this, which is e to the power j naught a dagger out. Just by the definition of the exponential function. Sum over, e to the power x is sum over n, 1 over n factorial x to the power n. Same deal with this. It's minus j naught times all of that. But that's just e to the power j naught a dagger out. And the whole shebang multiplied with this. Now, in the next step, we use a very common trick. See, I'm going through these things in detail because we're going to use tricks that might look strange if you encounter them the first time now, but they come up all over again. So it's important to have seen them in detail at least once. So in order to work out what this is, remember, what's the difficulty here? We have A out dagger acting on zero out, which is okay, but we also have an A out here, and it's not clear how we can simplify this. Here's the trick. This term can be written like that. It looks like we are making things more complicated, but you will see soon that it actually helps. Why is this the same as that? Here I wrote down the commutator between A out and e to the power j naught A dagger out. The commutator has two terms, okay, this times that minus the other way around. And the first term, this times that, is of course this one, right? Easy. So the first term of the commutator is this term that we want to represent. The second term in the commutator has the e to the power j naught a dagger out on the left, and it has the a out on the right, and it comes with a minus sign in front of it. That's an extra term that we didn't have in here, so I'm subtracting it here by writing it over here with a plus sign. In the commutator, it comes with a minus sign. Here I'm writing with a plus sign, so overall, it's not there. Therefore, this term is really the sum of those two. We're adding this term here, certainly did no harm because the A out acting on the zero out annihilates that term. So from here onwards, we can forget about that term. It's annihilated because it acts on that. Oh, this, by the way, is just carried forward. Right, that term is just carried forward over here. And that term goes away. So now we have to worry about that commutator. What's that? Did that really help to have here the commutator between A out and e to the power j naught A dagger out? It turns out, for reasons that I'll explain in a moment, this sort of thing is always easy. When you have an A out commuted with some function of the A dagger, as in this case, easy. You want that kind of term because, as I will explain in a moment, the commutator between A and some function of A dagger is simply differentiating that function of A dagger with respect to A dagger. Formally, that's what it does. So the commutator turns out to be simply the derivative of this term with respect to A dagger, just formally taking the derivative of it. You see, if you differentiate this exponential, you get the exponential again, and then by the chain rule, differentiating this thing here, just get a j naught. So this, I'm claiming, is j naught times this commutator here. This exponential here again, e to the power j naught a dagger out. I'll get back to the reason why this commutator simplifies so much in a moment. Let's just take it as a given for the purpose of getting to the next step and arriving at the conclusion. And then we can come back to the issue of handling commutators like that. Okay, so if the commutator is really this, then what do we have as we go forward from this line to that line? As I said, this term goes away because we have an annihilation operator acting on its zero vector. And then we have j naught times e to the power of j naught a dagger. That's this term, j naught times e to the power j naught a dagger. We have the same term with a minus sign coming from here, minus j naught e to the power, it's this term. And we carry that one forward over here, even though we could have dropped it already because it's annihilating here. So this term annihilates when acting on the zero out. And that's just j naught minus j naught. That's zero. So that term goes away as well. And we conclude this whole thing is zero. Why is that good? Well, it's good because that's what we set out to do. We wanted to show that a out minus j naught acting on this stuff is equal to zero. Because this is a in. And that was claimed to be the vector zero in. That had to come out zero. So what we've just shown is that indeed this is the vector zero in. Because we have verified that it is annihilated by the operator A in. We haven't really completely shown yet that this is therefore zero in. We've only shown that it's annihilated by A in. And the ground state of the harmonic oscillator is unique. So we think, well, we are really close. The only thing that still needs checking is that this thing is actually normalized. Okay, so I leave it to you as an exercise to verify that this is normalized. What do you have to do for that? You take this vector and then write it down as a Brayer and as a ket. Not my microphone. Okay, so we have to write it down as a Brayer and as a ket, and then you see that you can write this thing with lots of A daggers, but when you make it a Brayer, it becomes lots of A's. So you have to commute lots of A's through lots of A daggers. And for that purpose, it will be useful to remember this business here with the commutator. Okay? So in this step star, in this last step here, from here to here, we use the fact that the commutator of A out with e to the power of J naught A dagger out is given by that. As an exercise, please try to show that from the commutation relations between the A and A dagger, it follows that, see, and there doesn't have to be an in or an out. It's just general. Whenever you have two operators, A and A dagger, obeying these commutation relations, then when you have the commutator between the A and any function of A dagger that you can write as a polynomial or power series, any such commutator gives you simply the derivative of that function of A dagger. So if this was, for example, e to the power A dagger, well, the commutator between A and e to the power A dagger is e to the power A dagger. Because the derivative of the exponential is the exponential. And you can prove that term by term. Of course, in principle, there's an issue of convergence of power series of operators. But if you do it for polynomials, you can prove that strictly. Here are the first few steps. We know that the commutator between A and A dagger is 1. The commutator between A, see, and this is like differentiating A dagger with respect to A dagger. Okay? If you differentiate X with respect to X, you get 1. If you differentiate A dagger with respect to A dagger, you expect 1. Now, if you calculate the commutator between A and A dagger squared using this, you get 2 A dagger. It's like differentiating A dagger squared 1. And if you calculate the commutator between A and A dagger to the third power, work it out, you find it's 3 A dagger squared. And commutator between A and A dagger to the fourth power, it's 4 A dagger to the third power. It's basically because you have the Leibniz rule built into the way that commutators operate. So you can prove by induction that this always works. You can put it for an nth power, and once you have it for the nth power, that the commutator between A and A dagger to the nth power is n times A dagger to the power n minus 1. Then you can argue by linearity that it will work for all polynomials. And then if the functional analysis works out, you can also have it for power series. Okay, so that's a step that is very often used. Remember that trick, that the commutator of A with a function of A dagger gives you the derivative. Okay, and then using this kind of machinery, try to prove that this representation of zero in is valid in the sense that this is also normalized. All right. We have shown that if a harmonic oscillator is in the ground state initially, before the force acts, then after the force has finished acting, its state gamma obeys A out gamma is equal to J naught gamma. Because this is really the equation that A in annihilates zero in. Right? A in is A out minus J naught. So we can rewrite this as A out minus J naught, acting on gamma is equal to zero. Okay, and that is to say that A out minus J naught acting on zero in is equal to zero, which is to say that A in acting on zero in is equal to zero. Okay, I'm not saying anything big here, just reminding you. So my point is that the state of our quantum system is an eigenstate of an annihilation operator. The state of our system used to be eigenstate to, at early times, it was, it is eigenstate to A in with eigenvalue 0. It's eigenstate to A out with eigenvalue J naught. Eigenstates to annihilation operators are called coherent states. I think I mentioned that earlier. And the significance of this is that when you use charges and currents to produce electromagnetic fields, for example, you're bound to produce them in a coherent state. The electromagnetic field waves, they are going to be in a coherent state, as we discussed earlier. And also, I think as I mentioned earlier, the coherent states are states that are as classical as states can be, in the sense that the product of the uncertainties is as low as possible. In regular quantum mechanics, it means that the product of the position and momentum uncertainties is equal to h bar half, which is the lowest possible. In the case of electromagnetism, it's roughly speaking that the uncertainty in the electric field multiplied with the uncertainty in the magnetic field is as small as it possibly can be. Now let's verify that for quantum mechanics quickly. Again, it's a little bit of an exercise in working with the A and A dagger. Also to point out that you can calculate all of these things without ever working with position wave functions of the harmonic oscillator. No Gaussians or Hermite functions needed to figure this out. So in order to verify that, we need to calculate what is delta Q and what is delta P for a coherent state. For example, for our for the state of the harmonic oscillator after the force has acted. I mean, it's still the same state, but its role has changed. So we need to calculate the uncertainty in position, for example. And remember how that works. You take the position operator, subtract from it the mean value. It works for any observable if you want to calculate the variance. This is the variance. So you take the observable minus the mean value of the observable times the identity operator. Then square the whole thing and calculate the expectation value of that. So it's the mean quadratic deviation. It's the mean of the deviation, of the squared deviation from the mean. And when you expand that out, you find that it is always simply the expectation value squared. It's the expectation value squared minus like that. And I'm in the writing mode. Okay. So now we have that this equation holds. In our case, it's A out, but it doesn't really matter whether it's A out or in or anything. So we simply have an annihilation operator. The state under consideration is an eigenvector to the annihilation operator with some eigenvalue J naught. We have a particular application in mind, of course, but it doesn't really matter where this is from. It doesn't even have to be the case that we deal with harmonic oscillators. This could be for a hydrogen atom or whatever system you like, because we're not talking about dynamics. It's just kinematics. So the system is in a state which is annihilated by an operator A, which obeys commutation relations with its adjoint such that that commutator of A dagger is equal to 1. So then we defined the position operator in terms of the A and A daggers. Actually, we defined the A and A daggers in terms of the position momentum operators, but we can invert that. And so we get Q in terms of A and A dagger, P in terms of A and A dagger this way. If we're dealing with a harmonic oscillator, these particular prefactors are the preferred choice. But if you're dealing with another system, we can always express our Qs and Ps in terms of some linear combinations of A and A daggers. It's a matter of convenience to make that particular choice. If you remember, we had these two parameters alpha and beta that we fixed in such a way that the commutator between the A and A dagger came out to be just 1, and such that the Hamiltonian simplified so that there were no A dagger squared terms and no A squared terms. Okay, so what is the position expectation value? Well, we put the Q hat operator in there, and the Q hat operator is this one. So we can plug that in here. Remember that when A is acting on gamma, it produces the eigenvalue J. When A dagger is acting to the left on gamma, then it produces the complex conjugate J star. So therefore, the position expectation value is given by this, basically the real part of J. And the variance can be calculated similarly. It comes out this way. This is just the square of it. Now we calculate the variance of it. Now we calculate, the expectation value of the square of Q. The variance comes out over here. So now we have to take this operator Q, here it is, and we square it. We get these terms. When A is acting on gamma, it produces an eigenvalue, which is J. When it acts twice, it produces J squared. That's what we have here. A acting on gamma produces J. A dagger acting on gamma produces a J star. And here we have that we can rewrite this as A dagger A plus 1, if you want. And we have an A dagger squared. We have that when the A acts, in this case, when the A acts on the gamma on the right, it will produce a J. And when it acts on, when the A dagger acts to the left on the gamma, it will produce a J star. So we get a J star product over here, but we also get a 1 from that commutator. That's over there. So overall, we get this expression here, where in this you recognize that it matches what the Q bar squared was. But this thing is extra. That arises from the non-commutativity here. And so we find that the variance, the size of the quantum fluctuations of Q, which is given by this minus that, given by this minus that, is just this, 1 over 2 omega. This term and that term goes away. I'm missing the state gamma. In which line? This one? Oh, yes. Thank you. Okay. It's very difficult to write like this. Okay, now the momentum uncertainty can be calculated very, very similarly, and we get an omega half out of this. So then the uncertainty of, and then delta q squared times delta p squared clearly gives us a 1/4. So delta q times delta p gives us 1/2. And that is as good as it gets. So we showed that indeed, whenever we have eigenstates to annihilation operators, they will saturate the uncertainty principle, and therefore they will be coherent states. Now, let's apply all of this to quantum field theory. Quantum field theory with driven harmonic oscillators. So we have some other field, which may be classical or quantum, that's driving our harmonic oscillators. Actually, we are assuming that it's classical for now. So something like charges and currents of electricity driving the electromagnetic field. Then structurally, this is how the Hamiltonian looks like. The Hamiltonian of the Klein-Gordon field is over here. And then we are adding to this a term that can drive the field. It's called J because in electromagnetism, currents and charges are usually abbreviated with J. Of course, we're neglecting here the vector character of currents and the vector character of fields. But for the purposes that we have in mind here, it really doesn't, it doesn't change things qualitatively. So let us now assume that the external driving, the charges and the currents, are only there inside that interval from 0 to t. And before and after, there are no charges or currents that drive the electromagnetic field. So again, it will suffice to consider the periods of early time and late time before and after the charges and currents did their job. Because then, in those early and those late times, the quantum field theory is simply undriven. The Hamiltonian takes this form. What do we have to do at early times or at late times? Well, we have to solve the Klein-Gordon equation. Remember, this is how it looks like. And we have to solve the canonical commutation relations. They look like that, with the Dirac delta here on the right-hand side, not the Kronecker delta. Let us Fourier transform that, not a Fourier series transform, but a proper Fourier transform. Then we obtain Fourier coefficient functions, phi k of t. Remember that in principle, we may want to put this k here as an argument there, but it's tradition to write it as an index. Remember that the function phi hat of t for a fixed value of k is called a mode function. It's called a mode. Mode function will be something else. It's called a mode. So you hold one momentum fixed, and that's called the mode. The position fields obey these conditions. After Fourier transform, we find that those phi k fields obey this equation of motion and that commutation relation. So the Fourier transform lets us rewrite those two equations as those two equations. What we see here is that the Klein-Gordon equation has now split into an infinite number of ordinary differential equations. This was a partial differential equation because it involved both the time derivative and space derivatives. But this is an ordinary differential equation because it has only one kind of derivative, the time derivative. And what used to be special derivatives have just become k's. So for each fixed k, this is just an equation of motion which looks like that of a harmonic oscillator. When we write k, we will always mean sum over k1 squared plus k2 squared plus k3 squared, at least on flat space. And this is also omega k squared. This whole thing is omega k squared, because this is the backdriving force constant for the harmonic oscillator. The canonical commutation relations after Fourier transform take this form with a plus sign here. Also, remember that the field was classically real-valued, just like the electric field is real-valued field. So here we had a scalar field that's real valued. After quantization, these things are operator valued, but those operators are now assumed to be self-adjoint. So phi of x and t dagger is phi of x and t. After the Fourier transform, we find that this condition translates into that condition. Phi hat dagger of k is phi hat of minus k. So now we follow the solution strategy that is due to Fock again. And we will do everything in parallel. Just to remind you, this is what we did in quantum mechanics. This is what we do in quantum field theory. We can proceed completely analogously. So in quantum mechanics, we said, well, we can write our Hamiltonian in terms of Q and P, but it will be convenient to define a new variable A of t with suitable brief prefactors such that the commutator between A and A dagger comes out to be 1, and such that the Hamiltonian is very simple in terms of A and A dagger, doesn't have A dagger squared terms, doesn't have A squared terms. And in quantum field theory, we can do exactly the same thing. Instead of working with the observables phi k or with the central quantities phi k and pi k, we can choose suitable prefactors such that the A operators for each k, so we do this now for every mode k, such that the AK have commutation relations with the A dagger k, such that on the right hand side we have a Dirac delta, and such that the Hamiltonian comes out as simple as possible. The main difference between here and there is that here we're considering just one harmonic oscillator, and we don't need an index over here or there or there. But a field has one harmonic oscillator for every wave vector, for every wavelength, and for every direction. So we have one harmonic oscillator for each k, therefore we have a whole bunch of variables there, uncountably many actually. Now, the equations of motion for the q and the p in quantum mechanics reduced to one equation of motion for a, namely that a dot is equal to minus I omega a of t. And clearly this has a very simple solution in the case that there's no driving force. It's just this equation, obviously, it's just can be solved with an exponential because the derivative is proportional to the actual. And the commutator comes out this way. In quantum field theory, same deal. We basically simply have extra, we have plenty of those, one for each wave vector k. And the commutation relations come out this way. Now, with the proper sign here, k minus k prime, comes out this way. This will soon change because even though we may not have a driving force, we will have that the frequency can change in time. In this case, this becomes more complicated. But not yet. We're still considering the case of just having an external driving force. And we are here specializing on the time before it acts and the time after it has acted. And in both cases, this is the equation of motion. So now we can solve this using an initial condition again. So we have what the A operator in is, but the A in is early. Then we find that this solves the equation of motion just with the exponential. So all we have to make sure is that A in is an operator that obeys these commutation relations early on. And we can make sure of this by constructing the Fock basis. Because if we start with a vector 0 in that's annihilated by A in, and then we construct the Fock basis by applying A dagger in repeatedly, we not only obtain a Hilbert basis and a Hilbert space, we not only get a bunch of vectors which span a Hilbert space, but also in that Hilbert space, this will hold by construction. Because when we work out how a in acts on a vector which is generated by applying a dagger in on the vector zero in, we always use those commutation relations. We're implementing them. So when we do the fork construction, we are actually constructing an operator a in together with its a dagger in, which by construction obeys that. You can write it down as a matrix. In fact, I invite you to do this. Consider the basis in the Hilbert space, which is given by 0 in, 1 in, 2 in, 3 in, 4 in, and so on. And then ask, how does this operator look like in that basis? What is it as a matrix? Just calculate the matrix elements between n in and m in with this operator in between. It's a bra of n in, then that operator, and then it's the ket of m in. You can work out what that is, because n in and m in can be written in terms of a daggers acting n times or m times on that vector, zero in, and then work out the commutation relations, and you find out what that matrix element is. And what you will find is that a in is a matrix in that basis, in the Fock basis generated from a in. It is a vector. It's a matrix which is almost diagonal. It doesn't have stuff on the diagonal, but it has on the line just next to the diagonal. And that's all. Everything else is zero. And the A dagger is just, you know, the Hermitian conjugate and transpose, the complex conjugate transpose of it. And then when you take those two matrices as matrices and multiply one with the other, and then the other way around, take the difference, you find it's one. Try it. Great fun, and it gives you an insight into how these things operate. Okay, so similarly here, in quantum field theory, we construct, you could say we're assuming an initial operator for A in for each mode K, but you can also say we construct one that obeys these conditions. For every K separately, we do that. So we have a Hilbert space which is given by the tensor product of all the Hilbert spaces for each k. For each fixed k, it's just this business. But we have plenty of them, and so we have the tensor product of all those Hilbert spaces. We have lots of systems that are all in place at once, one for each mode. Explicitly, in quantum mechanics, we obtain that the q of t is given in this way. We had this earlier. Remember, we calculated what A in was as a function of time, namely this. We know how Q and P are expressed in terms of A and A dagger. So knowing what the time evolution of A is, we can work out what the time evolution of Q is and what the time evolution of P is. And it just comes out to be this, obviously, right? Because of that and this, right? Just invert that, express Q in terms of A and A dagger, and then express A in terms of this, and then you can express Q hat of T in terms of some functions and the A in and the A in dagger operator, okay? In quantum field theory, same deal. We can work out what the time evolution is of the A in operators for each of the modes. We can then express what the time evolution of the A is, the AK for each K for each time. And this is now for early times. And then we can do the same thing. We can express the phi and the pi in terms of the A and the A daggers for all of the modes. And this is what we end up with, just the same way as we did here, except that here we do it for each mode individually. Let's call this equation S. We will later refer to that again. So this is solving the quantum field theory for any time period when there is no force acting. And I've put here an in, just to put something there, right? So this is what it is for early times, but the same calculation gives us an expression for the field at late times as well, and then it would be the A out. This is the Fourier coefficient, the operator-valued Fourier coefficient. We can do a Fourier transform of those, and then obtain what the field is as a function of space and time, the operator-valued self-adjoint operator-valued field as a function of space and time, and we obtain this. This follows from that simply by Fourier transform. And you see, the only difference between this and that is that there are extra Fourier factors e to the power ikx, because we did a Fourier transform with respect to k. You see how this is nicely covariant, which is not entirely trivial, because quantization is something that is seemingly breaking Lorentz invariance, because we pick a point in time, and then we do the quantization condition along space. But it turns out that once you're done with all of this, you get an expression which is exactly the same before or after a Lorentz transformation, because of the covariance of the expressions in there. So now, what about the Hilbert space of states? Analogous to the case of quantum mechanics, there is a vector, zero in the Hilbert space, which obeys, oh, there's a k missing. Well, actually, no, don't need the k, because it's true for all k. So there's a vector, let's call it zero in, which is annihilated by all of the annihilation operators for all of the modes at once. So it's the ground state for all of the harmonic oscillators, for each one of the modes, for all wave vectors. Now, the Hamiltonian at early times can then be written in this way. Remember, there is no force acting. We had this expression earlier. And there's no force acting, so there's no j phi term over here, because it's early times before the force acts. And I leave it to you as an exercise to verify that this expression turns into that expression when you express the pi and the phi in terms of the a and the a dagger. Just plug in the definitions and then rely on this clever choice of coefficients, you know, the alpha and beta, such that the Hamiltonian comes out simple and doesn't have a and a dagger squared or a squared terms in it. Because a priori you would expect that. You see, this is like a phi squared term. Phi is something like a plus a dagger. If you square that, you would expect mixed terms, a dagger, a terms, but also a squared terms and a dagger squared terms. But we chose the coefficients in such a way that those terms go away and the Hamiltonian takes this simple form. When we did this same calculation for just one harmonic oscillator, then we had here p squared, omega squared, q squared, and we got here omega a dagger a plus 1/2. Okay, that was the usual thing for the ordinary harmonic oscillator. But here we have 1/2 times the Dirac delta. And not just the Dirac delta, it's the Dirac delta at zero. If it were any other value, like 7, it'd be fine, it would be zero. But Dirac delta of zero is, that's where it peaks. That's infinity there. And that is a remnant of having to commute the a and a daggers. You see, when you take these terms here, you get, sometimes you get an a dagger here and an a over there. And sometimes you get an a over here and an a dagger over there. By arranging it such that we have only this term in this particular order, a dagger here and a there, which is convenient because whenever it acts on a zero in, it will annihilate. Then we get terms in both orders. We use the canonical commutation relations to get them all in this order, and then we pick up that term, which is really, I mean, physically, we would expect that sort of thing. It's, you know, we're talking about the energy here, and that's the ground state energy, 1/2 h bar omega. That's over here, right? But it's infinity. And that infinity is what is called an infrared infinity, an infrared divergence. Remember, we talked about infrared and ultraviolet earlier. Infrared in high energy physics, in theoretical physics, infrared is code. It's a code word meaning large distances, long wavelengths, huge. And ultraviolet is a code word that means very short wavelengths, very, very short, the limit of arbitrarily short wavelengths, just like infrared means the limit of arbitrarily large wavelengths. So this arises because we deal with arbitrarily large wavelengths. Does anybody see why that is so? What if we did not work with arbitrarily large wavelengths? If we put everything in a box, right? If we put everything in a huge box, if we say that we do physics in a box of size, you know, 100 billion gazillions light years, right? Then we wouldn't have Fourier transform. We would have a Fourier series. And remember, we did this earlier. When we do a Fourier series expansion, then we get that the A and the A daggers don't have a Dirac delta. They have a Kronecker delta. Okay? The commutator between A and A dagger then comes out to be a Kronecker delta. So in that case, then, if you assume that the system is large but finite size, then you regulate that. And then that's finite. So the infrared divergence is then gone. But at the same time, this is also an ultraviolet divergence. Because we are also assuming here that we have arbitrarily short wavelengths, that we have arbitrarily large omegas and arbitrarily large k's. You see, we are integrating over all k's. If this is a Kronecker delta and that is a 1/2 for each mode, we are still integrating this 1/2 over all of d3k. That's the divergence too. Right? So even after we put the system in a box and this becomes finite, we're still integrating here over R3, the omega k, d3k, and then that's a divergence, and that is a serious one. The infrared divergence is not serious. We can always assume that we are working with a system that's very, very large, gazillions of light years across, and then whatever happens at the boundary where we cut off cannot affect the physics here. So infrared divergences are not taken seriously. I mean, yes, you have to deal with them mathematically, but you can remove them by a simple mathematical trick that has physically no consequences. But the ultraviolet is more serious. Here we would actually have to assume that at short distances, something funny is happening. The physics changes. We, for some reason, don't have to integrate over arbitrarily small wavelengths. And this has led to all sorts of speculative work on quantum gravity. It's assumed that quantum gravity somehow implies that we don't have to carry that integral all the way to infinity, so that that still comes out finite. Problems don't end there, though, because if you remember, you've probably heard that the assumption in quantum gravity is that indeed there is a smallest wave. That's the smallest length scale, right? Like in string theory, nothing smaller than the smallest string size. In loop quantum gravity or any other theory of quantum gravity, really, the assumption is that at the Planck length, somehow the notion of distance loses meaning. Somehow we don't have wavelengths shorter than the Planck length. Somehow we don't have to integrate, right? Don't have to integrate for k larger than wavelengths that correspond to the Planck length. So one might think, okay, that solves the problem. That solves the problem. We simply don't integrate all the way. We integrate only over those momenta whose inverse is the Planck length. And thereby, this becomes finite. It's true. It becomes finite. And the ground state energy, the contribution to the Hamiltonian, becomes finite. And you can even make a prediction then what the vacuum energy is. And remember, vacuum energy has been found. It's dark energy. Right? And it in fact makes up 70% of all of the energy in the universe, dark energy. And this is a prime candidate for where the origin of the dark energy could be. It could be simply the ground state energy of all the modes of the quantum fields. So how does the prediction compare with the measurement? The prediction is that we have to cut this off at the Planck scale. Then we integrate this up. And we get a finite result, finite energy, or energy density. You see, we put it in a box, and then we get here the Kronecker delta. We have a sum. We sum all of this up to the Planck scale for the omegas. And then we get a total energy in the box divided by the volume in the box. We get energy density, and we can compare that with energy density that has been measured. Does anybody know what the comparison is like? Yeah, about 120. The worst prediction ever. Worst prediction ever in physics. Nobody knows why that is not gravitating like hell. That stuff should gravitate like hell. It's a lot. I mean, even if you cut off, not at the Planck scale, but if you cut off at like 10 to the minus 10 meters, okay? We know that quantum field theory works down to 10 to the minus 19 meters, even 10 to the minus 20 meters. That is what the LHC is pushing now. It's testing quantum field theory to such small scales. But if you just assume that quantum field theory stops working, you don't have to integrate for more than 10 to the minus 10 meters. So you have way less to integrate over. You get way less energy. It's still way more than we see. It's very strange, but we work with quantum field theoretical modes in accelerators and even in tabletop experiments, even the hydrogen atom. Right? We work with modes. We know, we can predict their dynamics, work them in, and calculate predictions for the LHC or for the spectrum of the hydrogen atom to high precisions in quantum field theory. We know we work with modes whose gravitational, whose ground state energy doesn't seem to gravitate. Or if it does gravitate, it's offset by something. Nobody knows what it is. Why does the ground state energy, why does this 1/2 times that, why does it not gravitate? Or why does it gravitate so dramatically little? Nobody knows. It used to be thought for a long time, up until about 10 years ago or so, 15 years ago, that for some reason it just doesn't gravitate and therefore it's zero. Nobody knows why, but the assumption was, well, it's 120 orders of magnitude off. There must be some mechanism that sets it equal to zero. And people liked that idea, right? It's just, we don't know why, but it's just not gravitating. But now it turns out that there is vacuum energy. And so it's not as easy as that. One possibility is that there might be supersymmetry. If there's supersymmetry, then if it's unbroken, vacuum energy ought to be exactly zero, but it's not exactly zero. And supersymmetry is experimentally almost ruled out. So that's also not going to do it. In any case, it would have its breaking would have to be fine-tuned to an enormous extent to predict or post-dict, really, what the vacuum energy would be. All right. Okay, so now we can specify states in our quantum field theory. For example, the presence of 7 particles with momentum k prime and 2 particles with momentum k. We might want to write this down as this kind of state denoted like that. Here's normalization. Here's so many 8 daggers applied. I'm cheating a little bit because if you just choose 1 k exactly and you're doing a Fourier transform, then the probability actually is 0 to finding a particle net momentum. You have to smear it over a little bit. If you put it in a box, then you can do it. But again, you know, next lecture actually we will get much more into the particle concept and see how difficult that particle concept really is. But this is how in particle physics you would approach it. You would describe multiparticle states by applying simply a Dagger operators on your zero state.
If you had a third momentum k prime prime, yep, you applied a k prime prime to that, then you would annihilate the entire state.
Well, if you apply here an A to a third K prime prime, yes, you would annihilate the entire state. That's right. Because remember that for different Ks, they commute the A's and the A daggers. That's right. Okay, so I just wanted to say that you want to really smear that over with some prefactor function over various Ks. Okay, so now at late times, we have that the degrees of freedom here collected, I mean, the phi and the pi are collected in A for each mode, and each mode at late times is given by a phase factor times the A out for K, just the same way that we had it for the singular harmonic oscillator as well. And we know that since the overall structure of the harmonic oscillators is as before, they're simply driven harmonic oscillators, that the A out is the A in plus some J naught for each mode. So for each mode, we have a different amount of driving effectively, and so we have a J naught of K. So now we can construct the out basis in the Fock way. We start with a vector 0 out, which is annihilated by A out. And then we build all the out basis vectors by applying a dagger out to this vector and normalizing them by dividing by square root of n factorial. And then we obtain a basis for the Hilbert space made out of 0 in, the n in vectors, and the basis for the Hilbert space made out of the vector 0 out and whatever we get by applying a dagger out to it. Two bases in the same Hilbert space. But remember now that each of those Hilbert spaces, I mean, the Hilbert space of the quantum field theory, is the same one early as it is late. And that Hilbert space is the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces of all of those individual harmonic oscillators, of each one of the k's, each one of the modes. And in particular, we can now express, for example, the ground state vector that we prepared the system in, let's say, at an early time, in terms of the Hilbert basis that we construct at late time. And also notice that we may now have, we do have now more possibilities of how the Hilbert basis of early times maps into the Hilbert basis at late times. Because you could have that basis vectors of some harmonic oscillators, some modes at early times, mix with the degrees of freedom with the basis vectors of another harmonic oscillator. It doesn't have to go from just one harmonic oscillator to the same harmonic oscillator. You could have that the basis rotation is mixing these things, right? The evolution might just mix different modes. It's not excluded. In simple cases, it won't, but in general, it can. Okay, so then if we start, for example, the quantum field in the state 0 in, and we find that later out, forces have acted, then 0 in is not 0 out. And instead, it is some linear combination of the n out vectors with varying k's, varying n's, then it means we can now calculate what happened to the vacuum. We can calculate how many particles of what momentum have been created in the process, simply by calculating the bracket between this vector, which always describes the state in which the quantum field is in, and any one of the of these states. So we can ask, what's the probability amplitude for finding this many particles of that momentum? We can calculate it in this way. Let me end with a brief preview, namely the case of a time-dependent frequency. Remember, that's the case that we will encounter when space-time is expanding. So now the equation of motion is more general. We have that the frequency itself is time-dependent. That's why I put that in red there. And then instead of simply having that the field phi as a function of time, let me just remind you of what it looks like, what it looked like earlier. Here, we found that just like the position for the harmonic oscillator in quantum mechanics is some time-dependent linear combination of the A in and the A dagger out, A dagger in and A in, with some basically exponential prefactor. The same thing is true in quantum field theory for each one of the modes. But when the frequency is itself time-dependent, see, when the omega is itself time-dependent, there's no guarantee that it's simply this with a time-dependent omega. That would be very naive to think, because this has to be the solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. And so we now have two time dependencies, one in omega, one in t. It's not going to be simply this factor here. So therefore, we will have to look for something more general. We will try this ansatz, so this attempt at a solution. We will try to write the quantum field in momentum space in this way, that it's still a linear combination of A in and A in dagger, but with prefactors that are functions of time that we still have to determine. And only in simple cases will these be exponential functions, but in general, if the parametric driving is non-trivial, then these are going to be non-trivial functions. And these functions will be called the famous mode functions. That ansatz that is used all over the place in this field of quantum field theory and curved space-time is a very clever one, because it guarantees by its very structure a lot of what we need. For example, we need that phi hat dagger k is equal to phi hat minus k. If you look at the structure of this, well, yeah, that's guaranteed. If you take the dagger of the whole thing, what will happen is that this term goes into that term and that term goes into this term, except for the minus. So we guarantee that. So we have that this ansatz guarantees that condition here. Of course, we will use A in operators that have the appropriate commutation relations, which we can guarantee because we can do the Fock construction of a Hilbert space in which they have these commutation relations. So that's okay. So we have the commutation relations and we have the hermeticity conditions. But to arrange that these guys obey the right commutation relations doesn't automatically guarantee that this will obey the right commutation relations with pi. So will this commute in the right way with phi dot? We have to find out. So we have to calculate phi dot, that gives us the v dot. And then the commutation relations of the A and A dagger will translate into commutation relations of the phi. And the phi dot or the pi, and then requiring that their commutation relations are correct will give us a condition on the V. And let me give it to you here. And that condition turns out to be this thing. Sorry that I give you things slightly out of order. But that's the condition that we will find for that. Assuming that the A dagger obey the proper commutation relations. I mean, we will do this later in much more detail, of course. It's just a preview. Assuming that the A dagger obey the right commutation relations, which they do because we constructed in this way using the Fock method, then the phi and phi dot obey the right commutation relations if the V obey that. This is a Wronskian condition. If you know a little bit about the theory of differential equations, you may recognize that. It's very good that this is a Wronskian condition because we want the commutation relations obeyed at all times. And the Wronskian from the theory of differential equations is something that's conserved in time. Anyway, so that's what we have to solve. We have to solve for V a function that obeys this so-called Wronskian condition down there, which is really just a normalization condition, not a difficult thing to do. The more difficult thing to solve is for the equations of motion for phi. This has to obey the Klein-Gordon equation. How can we do that? Well, we can do that in a relatively simple way. You see, this and that, they are operators, but they don't have a time dependence. All of the time dependence is in these prefactor functions. And now, if this is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, and that is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, then this is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation as well. Because these things are simply constant. They are operators, but they're constant operators. So therefore, that ansatz will actually succeed. The hermeticity condition is obeyed by the very construction, the way it's written. The commutation relations will be obeyed as a matter of normalization. We just have to rescale our V so that the commutation relations come out right. And the equations of motion will be easy to obey because this will obey the operator Klein-Gordon equation if these things obey the Klein-Gordon equation for regular functions, because these are regular functions. So that will be the strategy then. And here's the proof, by the way, of how the Wronskian condition arises. I don't think we have to go through this now. We will do this more carefully later on. Maybe what you can do is read it in your own time. Just as a little proof that if the V obey the so-called Wronskian condition, then the phi and the pi obey the correct commutation relations that come out over here. So next time on Thursday, we will do a lecture on the famous Unruh effect. And that will be our first experience with the subtleties of what the particle concept is and how it can be that somebody who is traveling will see particles that somebody who is not traveling doesn't see. If that person is accelerated, if somebody who is accelerated generally will see particles where somebody who is not accelerated will not see them, and vice versa. And we will find out how that comes about. And it has to do via the equivalence principle with the Hawking effect as well. OK, so next time we do emission and absorption of particles in detectors, or atoms, and accelerated particle detectors and what they see. Okay, see you Thursday.